this is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. I'm David Alan Greer, and this is The Known World. This podcast has an unusual genesis. It began about a year ago, when I started receiving phone calls asking me to talk, which one always enjoys, and then being told that I was an expert on a certain subject. Well, I hardly consider myself an expert. As anyone who listens to these podcasts or reads the column knows, I work for a general view of computer science, of the technology business, and of all the things connected to it. Well, I asked, of course, what was this field that I was the alleged expert in? And the response came back, crowdsourcing. My response was quick and straightforward. Never heard of it. Well, in the weeks and months that have followed, I have spent more and more time in this field, which uses the internet to bring together large numbers of workers to focus on a single job, and begun to realize that it represents an interesting shift in our model of computing. We are so used to the tools of logic and deterministic models that when we introduce human beings, we get a little bit nervous when we realize that the answer may not come out the same way twice. It introduces the concept of a market, of an exchange, the exchange of some sort of recompense for a judgment, for an activity, for something that is difficult to do with a machine. And so, from that, we have a year of interesting talks and discussions and a podcast, which is called Not for All Markets. At times, especially following a major crisis in the nuclear industry or perhaps an attack on the global cyber infrastructure, our office becomes a little media market. Reporters contact us seeking a comment that's provocative, insightful, or counterintuitive, depending upon their tastes. In exchange, they offer a brief moment of fame, a boost to the ego with personal appearance on Great Day Pocatello or a quote in an obituary for someone who might have once been famous. My colleagues and I generally try to approach these transactions rationally, attempting to provide insightful answers for educational and policy purposes. However, when the choice is difficult, especially when we're facing deadlines or working on other tasks, we throw the request onto the trading floor and question whether providing a response is truly worth our time and effort. During the past couple of weeks, I've been spared requests from the media, as the scientific controversy of the moment has nothing to do with computing or information technology. The reporters, tiring of the crisis at the Japanese nuclear power generator, have turned their attention to a more recent announcement by NASA that it would place the retired space shuttles at museums in Washington, D.C., New York, Florida, and California. Somehow this is a controversy, and it needs a scientific policy person to make comment upon it. At the bargain price of $28 million, plus a little change, the old shuttle orbiters generated far more demand than the supply on hand. In all, 29 organizations responded to NASA's request for information in the hopes of securing one of the relics. When the final announcement was made, 25 of these groups were disappointed, and more than a few of them were willing to express their feelings in an effort to change the decision. For example, organizations in Texas and Ohio provoked their congressional delegations to denounce the blatant politics behind the decisions and claim that NASA ignored the intent of Congress and the interest of the taxpayers. The public evidence suggests that NASA, a giant engineering organization with a well-formed understanding of national politics, approached this decision in a rational, highly engineered manner. Not only is NASA inclined to trust numerical approaches, its representatives understand that quantification can be used to deflect criticism. The appeal of numbers, wrote the philosopher Ted Porter, is especially compelling to bureaucratic officials who lack the mandate of a popular election or a divine right. He argued that a decision made by numbers has at least the appearance of being fair and impersonal. NASA actually has a 15-page policy document defining space artifacts and describing how they may be loaned to various types of organizations for public affairs, industrial outreach, and education programs. Hence, it requested a fair amount of information from the organizations that were interested in acquiring a shuttle orbiter. Much of this information was already in numeric form that directly related to the requesting organization's wealth and popularity. These statistics included attendance figures for the past 5 years, the budget for the same period, endowments, the local region's population, the number of hits on the organization's public web pages. Other information could easily be quantified using social science techniques such as the additional assets that the organization could use or its experience with artifacts of national significance. Even the most subjective question, which asked how the organization would use the shuttle to inspire the American public and students in particular, also required the description of a concrete procedure that could be used to assess, evaluate, and measure these objectives. With proposals providing quantifiable information, the NASA board could easily have slipped into a familiar procedure. This would have involved creating a matrix with multiple rows and some appropriate number of columns. The board would then have converted much of that information into a 5 or a 7 or a 9 point scale, in which the low value represented a poor contribution, the middle value being a neutral contribution, and the high value expressing a substantial asset. A quick summation of figures would have identified the proposals with the highest numeric score. Then the board could have determined if this result could be presented to the grand public as a final judgment. Such a process, though rationally disciplined, is less connected to the scientific method than it might appear. It's actually part of a market process in which the parties lay all their assets on the table and ask if they have sufficient wealth to complete a trade. Markets include not only quantification, but valuation, the act of ranking the importance of goods, services, and ideas. Valuation is often far from scientific. "It is vague and arbitrary," wrote the 19th century economist Jean-Baptiste Say, "when there is no assurance that it will be generally acquiesced in by others." It can also be quite dynamic, as the desires and aspirations of those in the market change. The world of computation has had an awkward relationship with markets. For computable answers, we rely on logic, mathematics, and probability. In his 1854 masterwork, An Investigation of the Laws of Thought, George Boole argued that the mathematical sciences occupy a fundamental place in human knowledge, and that no system of mental culture can be complete or fundamental which altogether neglects them. We use these tools to participate in, model, and predict the opportunities in markets. But we rarely allow markets to give us an answer to our computational questions beyond the current value of the products we create. Over the past 4 or maybe 5 years, markets have begun to creep into computational processes as a way of answering difficult questions, questions that deal with the efficient use of resources. One of the more intriguing forms of computation that employs markets has come to be known as crowdsourcing. Crowdsourcing is generally understood to be a way of using the internet to employ large numbers of dispersed workers. As an example of crowdsourcing application, employer can post a task on a website and invite workers to undertake all or part of it. Sometimes the task requires substantial skill and training, such as a programming assignment or resolving a legal problem. In other cases, it requires only basic human perception, such as the ability to identify faces in a photograph and judge the emotions that such faces are expressing. In general, crowdsourcing is an industry that is attempting to use human beings and machines in large production systems. These systems prove to be useful and efficient when each element does the work that it can do best. Machines carry out repetitive tasks while people make judgments, handle pattern recognition, and synthesize ideas. Perhaps the most familiar version of crowdsourcing is Wikipedia, which relies on tens of thousands of volunteers to construct an online encyclopedia. Another common example is Amazon's Mechanical Turk, which offers human intelligent tasks, or HITS, HITS. At this point, the list of firms interested in this field is long and is growing rapidly. It includes companies that handle customer relations, create metadata for photographs and other non-textual items, and gather data on product placement and consumption. All crowdsourcing applications have four basic elements: a division of labor, computing and communications technology, a crowd of human workers, and a labor market. Sometimes the market is used merely to recruit workers to the project. In Wikipedia, for example, the market is implicit in the basic wiki interface. Workers bring to that market the material they've written on specific subjects. The transaction is completed when the work is accepted for publication. The worker is compensated by the privilege of having the work posted online, at least temporarily. In other cases, the labor market is used to extract ideas from the workers as a whole. Recently, I was talking with Kwame, the owner of a firm that offers crowdsourced translation services. At base, his organization allows companies to put documents that they wish to have translated on the web and pays workers to translate them. His system has a few additional tools that enhance the quality of the work. It can provide an initial mechanical translation, offers style rules, and saves translated text for possible reuse. It also allows the employer to gather useful information from the labor market. The value depends on who's using the translations, Kwame said. You get the greatest value when you're translating documents that are used in the field. Well, Kwame has two types of clients, one that gathers information, the other that disperses it. In the first case, the organization draws its translators from those who gather the information. In the second, it can find translators among the people who actually use the information. The crowd is most useful in the second case, Kwame explained, as these translators help the employers understand the value of the translated documents. The second kind of clients usually are firms that sell large, complicated products that come with lots and lots of documentation. Traditionally, the firm would create all of its documents in English and then pay for the translation of a few key documents, such as an overview of the system, or perhaps an index of key documents. Paying to have all the documents translated into all possible languages would likely create a lot of work that would remain unused. In Kwame's system, the translators are drawn from the people who actually work with the product, who generally they're bilingual employees who are supplementing their income. They're presented with all the base language documents and are allowed to choose the documents that they want to translate. According to the theory of markets, the crowd will choose to translate the documents that are of most value to them, and by extension, to those who are supporting, maintaining, and extending the product. Of course, this market theory of translations has drawbacks that counter the potential advantages. All markets tend to have a notoriously narrow vision. Participants value those things that will help them today rather than something that might be useful next year, such as that rare document containing information that will only be needed in the case of a complete, absolute, and massive failure. While the defenders of market-based decisions will support these choices by arguing that the market makes the most efficient choices, not one of them desires to face an acute crisis with a procedure manual that needs to be translated on the fly from one tongue to another so that it can be used properly. So, like all markets, we modify the rules of the crowd labor markets to protect ourselves against risk. Of course, some of these modifications can be handled through the pricing mechanism of the market itself. The organization needs to have certain documents translated first, such as that emergency manual. If it needs it, it can offer premium prices for the work. However, the standard market mechanisms won't solve all the weaknesses of the labor markets in crowdsourcing. Critics have noted that the dispersed labor pool in crowdsourcing leaves plenty of opportunities for workers to make mistakes, to cheat, to plagiarize, and even get paid for completely vacuous submissions. Wikipedia, as a note, is often the source of some of these vacuous or plagiarized submissions. Most companies engaged in crowdsourcing use a complex set of rules for their labor markets to minimize potential problems. Each piece of data is independently checked by multiple crowd workers, explains the leader of one company. His organization also rates each worker by seeding the market with tasks for which it already knows the result. Ineffective workers are filtered out, he adds. Of course, free markets are never truly free. In many spheres of modern life, we've structured markets to minimize both risks and transaction costs. Supermarkets, online auctions, even the little media mart that forms in our office whenever science and technology are in the news. The reporters who come to us know that we're unlikely to feed them a quote, supplying wrong or embarrassing information. They've restricted their crowd of workers to a mere handful of policy wonks, a group of policy wonks that they believe will be right and will ultimately minimize their risks. Well, you've been listening to The Known World. This podcast was based on an essay published in the May 2011 issue of Computer, which is a publication of the Computer Society. More about Computer and the Computer Society can be found at www.computer.org. More about this podcast can be found at www.computer.org/podcast. If you have any comments, we would love to hear them. You can send them to podcasts@computer.org. I need to add that the music for this podcast came from the Music Alley PodSafe Network, and you can find it at musicalley.com. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you next time.